So today we will be continuing our study of the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, or the foundation, the establishment of mindfulness, or sati. You could also say the establishing of remembrance, or recollection. So yesterday we got through with the introduction, and we learned what are the four foundations of mindfulness, which are Gaya, which we translate as body, Vedana, which we translate as feelings or sensations, Citta, which we translate generally as mind. I've heard it translated as consciousness, but I think mind makes it easier to understand. And Dhamma. Dhamma is the teaching of the Lord Buddha. Here it means various classifications or groups of teachings, sort of like a mixed toolbox or sets of teachings which are going to present themselves to us when we practice, and we'll get into that in later days. So today we're going to start on mindfulness of the body. And mindfulness of the body is broken up into different parts. The first part is the mindfulness of breathing. Under contemplation of the body, we have mindfulness of breathing. And we can see that mindfulness of breathing was one of the most common types of meditation in the time of the Buddha. Even in Hinduism and in other religions at the time, the breath was considered to be the best object. Because when you're sitting still with your eyes closed, there's not much else going on. As I said on Thursday, when I was explaining the different types of meditation and talking about insight meditation, it's very difficult for us to just go in and try to understand our mind, because the mind plays all sorts of tricks on us. It's like trying to catch a wild animal. If you want to catch it, you have to surprise it. You have to catch it in its natural state. If it knows that you're there, you'll never get to see it the way it normally behaves. It will always be afraid or disturbed by your presence. And the mind is the same. When we go in and attack the mind, our mind can be very tricky and can trick us into misunderstanding it and lead us off on all sorts of wild goose chases. Many people, when they sit in meditation, they find themselves getting caught up in sort of special or abnormal experiences, where they find themselves leaving their body or floating or seeing things or hearing things, and they're not sure how to deal with these. It's the mind playing tricks on us. If we want to learn and come to see the mind in its natural state, it's considered that the best way to start is to instead focus on the body, as though we're not even interested in the mind at all. And just let it act naturally, kind of like forgetting about it and not putting any obvious attention on it. Because once we focus on the body, we're going to see how our mind reacts when we, in a normal experience. When we focus on the breath, we see how our mind tries to force the breath or tries to always coming up with some kind of judgment of whether it's good or bad, or trying to make it like this or trying to make it like that. We can see when the mind is focused or when the mind is not focused, and so on. So this is why we generally start with focusing on the body, and especially focusing on the breath, because it's the only part of the body that's really in motion or easily perceivable. And as I mentioned on Thursday, in general, mindfulness of breathing is considered to be a tranquility meditation, or a meditation on a concept. Because actually the breath is not a part of the body, right? Breath is this concept that we have when we feel the sensations. When you feel the sensations and the movements of the body, we have the this concept of breath going in. I mean, even in scientific terms, we consider it, it's the sensation of the air molecules, the cold air or the hot air coming in or going out, and it's that sensation which we're actually experiencing. So when we focus on the breath, when we watch the breath go in and watch the breath go out, we're actually not experiencing the breath, we're only experiencing sensations, we're experiencing a bodily phenomenon. So focusing on the breath is only focusing on a concept. So why then do we include mindfulness of breathing in mindfulness of the body? Well, one way to understand it is you can understand this section as simply a tranquility meditation. It's not really insight meditation. It's not really meditation that leads to enlightenment. But I don't think that's necessarily how we want to view this discourse. Unless we want to gain these states of high concentration, but when we look at how the Lord Buddha phrases it, he says that the four foundations of mindfulness are for the attainment of Nibbana, or freedom from suffering. They're for the attainment of the purification of the mind, which really in an ultimate sense can only come about by seeing reality clearly. So we have to focus on reality. And so the best way to look at this is to see, to use mindfulness of breathing in a Buddhist sense, and either look at the tip of the nose, which is a common way of attacking the breath, or focusing on the stomach. And either one of these makes a fairly good meditation object. When the breath goes into the body, the stomach will rise. When the breath goes out of the body, the stomach will fall. When the breath goes into the body, the nose becomes cool. When the breath goes out, it becomes warm, and so on. So focusing on these sensations, we can... It's taking some part of reality, some part of experience as an object. So here in mindfulness of breathing, we actually have a fairly standard explanation of the practice. And there's various different... First, it's explaining sort of what kind of experiences you want to be aware of when it's long. And this is really easy when you're focusing on this, on the stomach. And this is a really important passage where it says... I breathe in when long, when breathing in long, he thinks, I breathe in long. When breathing out short, he or she knows I breathe out short, and so on. It's clear from this that we're not trying to control the breath. The importance of this is, I mean, it seems kind of silly to have to illustrate it all, but the meaning is that we're not trying to make the breath long, and this is a real misunderstanding many people have. Or understanding in other religions. Their understanding is you have to force the breath to be long or make it very deep or so on. And actually what we're seeing here is the Buddha saying that however you're breathing, that's how we're going to watch it. And this is the theme throughout the sutta, something that we have to really get clear on and come to understand, is that in all of this practice, we're not trying to change anything. We're trying to understand it and to remember it. Remind ourselves of what it really is, so that we can remember, oh, this is just this. When there's pain, when there's suffering, it's only pain, it's only a sensation, and so on. So one way of doing this, I mean, you could try to use these Pali words like dighang pasasami, I breathe out long, dighang asasami, Digang basasami. But generally, we would not consider to use the word digang, which means long. We would just say asasami, pasasami, which means I breathe in, I breathe out. And these would be a really good mantra, as I was talking about on Thursday. If you're into mantra meditation, you could just use this as your mantra. Asasami, pasasami, asasami, pasasami. But in... Suppose if you're looking at the stomach, it's not really exact, because when you're focusing on the stomach, the rising of the stomach is not really a breathing in sensation. It doesn't really appear to be that way to the meditator. As I said, if you're practicing tranquility meditation or meditation based on a concept, then it'd be quite useful to say asasami, or breathing in, breathing out, or in, out, in, out, if you want to shorten it down in English. But in the practice of insight meditation, if you're trying to focus on reality, in this case, we might have to change these words a little bit, and generally that's what we do when focusing on the stomach. We say rising, falling. When the breath comes in, the stomach rises. We say rising. When the breath goes out, the stomach falls. We say falling. Just reminding ourselves of its real nature, keeping our mind from wandering or making more of it than it actually is. And it goes on. This is really a standard understanding of mindfulness of breathing, and actually some of it probably is based specifically on samatha. So experiencing the whole body, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole of the breath body, calming the activities of the breath body, or calming the activities of the body. So it's something which calms the mind down, at least in the very beginning. And this is a real truncated version of mindfulness of breathing. It actually goes on in the sutta on mindfulness of breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta, to talk about how you see impermanence, training yourself to see impermanence, training yourself to let go, and so on. But this is just a basic explanation of a basic meditation practice. One thing I didn't mention, I skipped over here just one part, just to go back up to where it says where you should, the place for meditation. If you see here, the Buddha was pretty keen on practicing in the forest. So we see Aranya Gato, gone to the forest, Rukamula Gato, having gone to the foot of a tree, Sunyakara Gato, having gone to an empty place. But also giving, you can see it also gives some leeway there, so we don't have to be in the forest to meditate, we don't have to go to the foot of the tree, but it is an encouragement to find an empty place. Sunyakara gato, gone to sunyakara, a empty sunya, which is shunya, shunyata, if you've ever heard the word for empty. So here we have empty place, like a room which has nothing, no obstacles, no distractions. Not exactly necessary. In the practice of samatha, of tranquility meditation on a concept, it's quite necessary. If you're going to try to focus your mind on one object, then of course you have to lose track of all the other objects around you, and so the fewer objects, the better. But again, remembering that this section is mostly just a copy and paste job from the discourse, which would be a much more involved with just finding tranquility, or starting out with tranquility. Therefore, it says, it talks about going to the foot of a tree and so on. But as we'll see later on, actually meditation can be practiced anywhere, so we don't have to feel discouraged that we don't have quiet places to meditate. In fact, in one sense, or on one level, we can practice meditation anywhere. And this is where we get into the next section, which is the modes of deportment. But first, if I can go over this last section, which is going to repeat itself in every section. If you look at the last paragraph in Mindfulness of Breathing, we have, thus he lives contemplating the body in the body internally. And as I mentioned, body in the body, we understand this already. In the body means in the whole of the body. Contemplating the body means some part of the body, and it also means that when we're focusing on the body, we're not mixing it up with feelings. We're taking reality apart and trying to give ourselves building blocks or categories of things so that we can be clear about what we're being aware of. So when we're watching the rising and falling, we're being aware of the body. We're not worrying about the feelings. But when a feeling comes up, if we feel pain or aching or so on, then we switch to mindfulness of the vedana, of the feelings. And we say to ourselves, pain, or aching, or happy, or calm, focusing and using that as a meditation. So this is what in the body means, just focusing. When we're focusing on the body, it's just a Pali construct. It doesn't have any special significance. It's just sort of confusing in English. So internally or externally, I don't have a lot to say about this. Internally, we generally understand when you're focusing on your own body, if you're focusing on somebody else's body, or it could mean focusing on the object, like the stomach, or focusing on the air when it internally focusing on the stomach, or externally focusing on the air when it touches the stomach. It's really just a technical term in that sense, where it means it can be looked at as either internal or external. The thing which is touching the body, like when you're sitting on the floor is external, and the bottom which is sitting on the floor, that's internal. And when they contact, this is what we're paying attention to. When you see something, the light touching the eye is the external, the eye is the internal, and so on. The next part talks about samuttaya dhamma, origination things. You could also put this as the nature of origination or arising, the beginning, the reality which is the beginning of the object. So what it means when something arises, being aware of the arising of things, or the dissolution of things. So what this means, and a lot of this might be quite unfamiliar for people who haven't really undertaken meditation practice, but for those of you who have, and remember today we're a little bit more advanced, so we're not going to try to cater to too much to beginners. What we're talking about is the arising of things and the cessation of them. When you're sitting and you're watching the stomach, when the rising occurs, when it begins, there's the arising of it. When it ceases, there's a cessation. And this is incredibly important and very, very difficult to understand in the beginning, but once you've practiced a little bit, you can start to see how important it is, because it's the eradication of the view of self, where we believe that there is something eternal or something constant. When we see everything arising and ceasing, we lose this view, and this is incredibly important. And it seems terribly benign to just say the beginning and the end, but that's exactly what we're going to come to see, and what we have to come to see, that everything that arises, yang kinchi samutaya dhammang sapantang nirodha dhammang. This was what the first disciple of the Lord Buddha said when he came to see at least a piece of the truth. He saw that everything that is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease. And for most of us that seems very benign, but when you practice meditation it certainly is not. And I'll leave it there. I think it's something that you have to practice for yourself, but something to keep in mind, that we're really looking at and we're really trying to see things from beginning to end. And that's useful as a meditation technique even in the beginning, to realize that when the breath starts, that's when we should start saying to ourselves, rising, all the way to when it ends. When the stomach falls, we should start to say, falling, all the way to the end. And that's enough for a beginner meditator, but just to explain a little bit about why that's important. It's also, another way of explaining is that, so we're in the present moment, we're not acknowledging something that happened already or something that hasn't happened yet. So either the origination, at some point in the meditation, the meditator will focus on the origination. At other times, what will become clear is the dissolution. And at other times, it will be clear that both the origination and the dissolution will become clear. This is what happens in meditation. This can be realized through meditation practice. Or he is aware, or the word or doesn't... I don't want to put too much attention on that. The meaning here is that his mindfulness is established with the thought the body exists. And this is driving home the point that we're just trying to see things as they are. And it doesn't mean you have to see the whole body and say atikayo, which means the body exists. What it means is that what we're trying to see is this is the way it is, nothing more. It's not good, it's not bad, it's not me, it's not mine. Mindfulness, this word sati, means to remember the bare minimum, the bare reality, the ultimate reality of it. So we have this, the Buddha saying, ati kayo. What he knows is ati means it is, kayo, the body is, thus is the body, not anything else. To the extent necessary, just for knowledge and remembrance. And the Pali here is, let me see, I just want to get it right. But sati pachupatita hoti, mindfulness just for the pati upatita, for the establishment of mindfulness. No, he establishes mindfulness thus atikayoti. Yavadeva yana mataya pati sati mataya anisito chaviharati. It's nice if you know Pali. I shouldn't go into too much detail because it's probably just going to confuse people. But the words here are pretty much how it's been translated, and the point is that just to the extent necessary for knowledge and remembrance. I guess the English captures it quite well. Sometimes I have a problem with Thai people where the Thai language doesn't quite capture it so succinctly as the English. And so I have to explain to them the reason why we're using this mantra. There's a real point here. We're trying to remind ourselves and create just knowledge and remembrance. And then the important part is that we live in this way. We live independent and clings to nothing in the world. And this is the profundity of mindfulness. That simply by remembering things for what they are, we live independent of them. There's no glue, there's no stickiness, there's no judgment of them whatsoever. We live in this pure state of awareness and cling to nothing in the world. And this is going to repeat itself, so this paragraph is quite important. This is sort of a reminder again and again of why we're practicing and how we're to practice. Okay, so the next section is the modes of deportment, and these are the four postures, or the four postures of the body. Along with all minor postures of the body. So, in generally, we understand in the meditation tradition, or the tradition that I follow, we separate movement out into four postures. So whatever position you're in is generally one of four, either standing, walking, standing, sitting, or lying down. And this is, again, just a meditation technique. You could think of millions of different poses and postures. But for the purposes of meditation and to make it easy for beginners, we always keep in mind these four, and we always try to think to ourselves, what am I doing now? So when we're walking, we just remind ourselves. We can even meditate while we walk. When you walk to work, you just say to yourself, walking, 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 every time you move your foot. Or you can say right, left, whatever keeps your mind in the present moment, knowing what you're doing and remembering what you're doing. And that's exactly what is being said here. In fact, you can see where they get the idea of using the mantra. It's already in the Pali. Gacchanto va gacchamiti pachanati. Gacchanto means when going. Gacchami is this word, this expression. I am going. Gacchami. It's very easy in Pali, in the Indian language. You don't have to say I am going. It's one word. So the whole I. Many people ask, why do you say I am going? We're trying to get rid of the idea of self. Well, in Pali, you don't have to. You don't have to say I am going. You just say gacchami, and it already means I am going. He goes gacchati. They go gacchanti, and so on. For I go, it's gacchami. And this is, it makes it very easy to understand for the meditator. You just say gacchami, 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 gacchami. In English, we just say walking, walking, walking. It's the way we say it in English is different. When standing, he understands. And it's not just understands. The word is pachanati. It means knowing clearly or knowing thoroughly. So it's kind of a special understanding. It's not just, yeah, I know I'm standing. Why do I have to use this stupid word again and again and again? It's, again, because we're trying to create a clear understanding, which is not an ordinary understanding. And the question in the commentary is, well, don't dogs know, don't jackals know when they walk, when they move? And the answer is yes, but their understanding is only the ordinary understanding that we all have, and it is not the understanding which does away with the idea of self, of soul, of me, of mine, of good, of bad, and so on. Now, if anyone has any questions, you're welcome to interrupt me. I'm just going to keep going if there are no questions. Today, sort of give a different feel to the whole thing, where you can ask questions while I'm talking. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, you're welcome to wait until I finish as well. I'll give a chance for everyone to ask questions. But I'm going to just keep going here a little bit longer. Try to get through as much of the body as possible. So the four postures, you can even do lying meditation. When you're lying down, you can just focus on the fact that you're lying, saying to yourself, lying, lying. And this is a really useful technique for people who have insomnia. I've heard many cases of people, I've had many cases of students of mine who used to have insomnia. I myself, when I was young, had insomnia. When I was going to school, going to university, it was terrible. That I remember lying awake, and the more you tried to sleep, the worse it got, the less sleepy you were, of course. And you're always thinking about when you have to wake up and so on. When instead you keep your mind focused on the reality, it really goes away. The way to deal with insomnia, just to get off on a tangent here, the first thing to do is to tell the people not to worry about sleep. We have this obsession with how many hours of sleep that we need to get, and it's really not true. If anyone has ever done intensive meditation, there are times where you don't need to sleep at all. But the first thing to reassure people is that if you were to lie awake all night, it would be a great thing because you could be mindful. For a person who's not mindful, it can be a terrible experience. For someone who is actually practicing mindfulness and really staying in the present moment, it's actually a wonderful experience, and it can be a great meditation practice. So once you've explained to people how to meditate, just having them use the time that they have, it's like, great, I'm not asleep yet, that means I've got all this time to meditate. And the truth of what happens usually is then they fall asleep in about 5 minutes because they're no longer worrying about it. But then also teaching them, the lying meditation, teaching them how to do lying and watching even the breath. You don't have to do it just sitting, but you can say to yourself, great, now I've got all these hours where I can just lie here and do a lying meditation. And when you do that, generally in about 5 minutes they're asleep. Isn't it recommended not to meditate lying but sitting? Yes, if you can sit up all night, that's the best. If you're able to sit in a cross-legged position all night, that would be the best, yes. But in general, that's not possible. So at the time when you have to lie down and be mindful. And actually, no, in fact, in some cases, lying can be better than sitting, to tell you the truth. For people who are very distracted, if you've been working hard all day, if your mind is very stressed and distracted, lying down can sometimes be much better than sitting, because when you're stressed out, you generally don't fall asleep when your mind is distracted. Lying meditation, this is, I guess, important to mention at this point, the four postures are not the same. Standing and walking are better for developing effort. So when you feel drowsy or lazy, you can take up walking meditation. Walking meditation can also be good after you've eaten, because after you've eaten, you can become very lazy and the food is trying to be digested and so on. So walking meditation can be very useful, both after you're eating and when you feel lazy or drowsy or tired. When you feel distracted, lying meditation is something that will calm the mind, and sitting meditation as well, but not to the same extent. So you can experiment with these. When you're tired, the best thing is not to lie down, for sure. But no, lying meditation, and that's the key here, is that your question sort of brings out, that I'm trying to make clear, is that apart from the first part, which is kind of hinting at the idea that we have to be in a certain place and in a certain way and practice in a certain posture, because it talks about keeping the body erect and sitting cross-legged. That section is actually quite out of place here, in a sense. It's kind of just the Buddha giving a preliminary meditation practice. Then he's going to go on and tell us about all the other ways that we can practice, which is much more all-encompassing, and that's really the thrust of this sutra, is that however, as you see, even after lying down, or just as his body is disposed, so he understands it. So you could be crouching, you could be leaning, you could be swimming. However the body is disposed, so he understands it. And then it repeats the beginning the paragraph from the last section. But if you're very mindful lying down, don't you lose your sleep and end up being tired in the morning? No, that's not true. If you're very mindful and you stay up all night, I've done it actually. When I came, it doesn't happen very often. Usually your concentration gets so strong that you just fall asleep in a very short time. But I'll tell you a story. When I came to Los Angeles, I think it was the first year, 3 years ago, when I came to Los Angeles to teach. And of course the time difference, right? So I got into Los Angeles, it was about 9 p.m. and it was just starting to get morning, but I figured, well, I'd been sort of up most of the time on the plane, so I really would be able to sleep probably some. But what they did right away is gave me an iced cappuccino to drink, and in those days I was still having that kind of thing. I don't drink that nowadays, but I hadn't really gotten strictly in my mind about what I would accept to drink and not. So I had this big iced cappuccino, and I got about halfway through it and realized what I was doing. And I was up all night. I didn't sleep that night, and I just lay awake all night and meditated, and it was really great. And no, I wasn't tired at all in the morning. I think this is a sad misconception that science has. I've even had doctors come to meditate with me who, to this day, still don't understand. I've had them go through periods where they don't sleep all night, and they still have this terrible view in their minds that it's somehow destroying them and doing bad things to them. And it's simply not true. There are people who go months, even years, without sleeping. I don't know if I've heard much about years, but I've heard months. That's actually quite common. But I can understand. I mean, in the West, I'm not trying to make fun of you or anything. I understand how this is this is what we think in the West. But in meditation, it's really not the case. I mean, the Buddha the night he became enlightened, he was up all night. I think that's the best example that we have. Does it mean you end up not needing sleep at all? Yes, it does. If you're in intensive meditation and not doing anything else, it's true that when you're working all day, you do need sleep. And in fact, most people do need a lot of sleep because their minds are quite restless and working very hard. So it's a chance for the body and the mind to relax. But if your body and mind are relaxed, then there's really no need for all that sleep. And many people can do with only 4 hours, 5 hours of sleep a night. Some people, my teacher, he's 86 this year. And if he hasn't changed his schedule, he only sleeps about 3-4 hours at night. He takes a break during the day, I think sleeps another hour or two, but he's 86. And it's incredible how much energy he has and how hard he works every day. He still teaches meditation every day, day in and out without break, travels around the world. Not so much around the world, actually, but he travels around Thailand anyway. I wouldn't expect that unless you become a monk and go off and live in the forest, you would be able to do without sleep entirely, but you should be able to sleep less. You'll find you just don't need it. The next section is perhaps even clearer, but it develops on the section before it. So not just in terms of the four postures, but in really everything we do. And this is really going to drive home the point. In going forwards, in going backwards, he or she is a person practicing clear comprehension. And this is a new word. This is actually a word that we got in the beginning, but I didn't actually go into detail with it. I think I skipped over it because it came at the end of last week's section. The section up at the top where the Buddha says, ardent, mindful, and clearly comprehending. These are the three factors that we need in the meditation practice. Ardent means we have to put out effort. Mindful is, of course, the making the acknowledgement. And clearly comprehending. Ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful. Clear comprehension is the awareness of it. It is a couple with mindfulness. They go together, they're paired together. Because you can't have clear comprehension without being mindful. And as soon as you're mindful, there's clear comprehension. Or simply comprehending the object is not enough, because then it leads you to extrapolate upon it and make more of it than it actually is. So we have mindfulness as a pair to keep you simply being aware of it. So once you're aware of an object, that's great, that's perfect. But in order to keep your mind just being aware of it, we have this mantra, or this mindfulness, this remembrance, or reminding oneself of the nature of that awareness, or of the object of that awareness, to keep the awareness coming back again and again. They go together. And the effort is the effort to continue doing this. So clear comprehension here simply means, it's another way of talking about being mindful. We're talking about the same thing, but now we're talking about all sorts of different activities wherein this can be carried out. Going forwards and going backwards. This refers generally to walking meditation. Many people are not aware that the Buddha and his followers practiced walking meditation. Actually, in the scriptures we have rules and guidelines on how to build walking paths. If you go to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha became enlightened, you can see the place where they say he did walking meditation after he became enlightened. And I've done walking meditation there. It's a wonderful place to do walking meditation, back and forth where the Buddha practiced. And it's just back and forth. You can see it's a line where he walked. So this is what this means, atikante patikante. Going forward and going backwards. Sorry, apikante patikante. Alokite vilokite, looking forward or looking back. When looking ahead, or when turning around to look at, when turning to look at something else. In bending and stretching. In wearing one's robe and bowls. Robes and bowl. That means in using things, when you lift something. I mean, we have all these, so we have all these practices that we have people try out after they start practicing, maybe 1 day, 2 days, then we have them increase it. So you're not just watching the breath when you sit, you're also being mindful in whatever you do. When you lift something, saying lifting. When you bend over, saying bending. Just reminding yourself and keeping, you know, everything can become a meditation. When you carry the bowl, lifting, or so on. When you straighten the robe, straightening. If you don't have robes, then. Clear comprehension equals mindfulness extended to other activities than bodily functions and bodily movements. Yeah, not exactly. I mean, you could kind of, the commentary goes into great detail about what are the four kinds of clear comprehension. You see, it says here the four kinds of clear comprehension. Actually, it only mentions one. There's no four kinds at all here. But the commentary has four kinds of clear comprehension. It's just really a way of speaking of the Lord Buddha. What he's talking about mindfulness the whole way through, but here he's just explaining it in a different way, talking about how you should do these things. That when you walk, don't just walk, be clearly aware of it. But what he means is, as we saw up in the top, atapi, sampachano, satima, having these three things. It doesn't mean that in this section you don't need mindfulness and you don't need effort. You still need all three. Comprehension is the knowledge, or the clear awareness of the object for what it is, of the object as being not self, of the object as being something that arises and ceases. But he's just putting emphasis on it here. He's not saying that's all you need, or that's this one is different from the other, or in other sections you don't need that quality of mind. It's just a manner of speaking in this section. Sampachanakari. He is one who makes, and actually clear comprehension is a poor translation as well. Jhana means knowing, pa, again we have this, knowing thoroughly, and sang means fully. So you could say fully or completely, or completely together, or he is endowed with complete or full awareness. He is one who does the act of creating clear comprehension, not even clear comprehension, full awareness or full knowledge. So it's actually a name of the person, Sampajanakari. He is someone who does this, and it's a manner of speaking. But this section is called the section on the four kinds of clear comprehension. It's just a name for the section. What's really important here is seeing how mindfulness extends into all actions and all parts of our life. And this is really something that everyone should be aware of, and many people are not, that meditation is not something you need to only do in the sitting position. Even to the point, and this is what many people are not aware of, in regards to what is eaten, drunk, chewed, and savored, in defecating, urinating, in walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, in walking and speaking and keeping silence, in standing and sitting and sleeping and walking and speaking and in keeping silence. It means that in everything we do, using the same technique as we have had above, like gacchanto va gacchamiti pacchanati, when going he knows I go, well, in bending he knows I bend, he, she, they. Now, in the next sections, sometimes I go a little bit off from the commentary and my explanation of these, but I'm trying to make it easy for everybody to understand. The next section is sort of an additional meditation. It's not mindfulness in the sense that I've been talking about it, mindfulness of ultimate reality. But I've mentioned this before on Thursday. This is actually considered to be a tranquility meditation. So when we look at this sutta, especially in this part, we're seeing that there are many different meditation techniques we can use. This next one doesn't really fit in with what I was talking about in the last sections. This one is just something that you can use as sort of a extension of your meditation practice. And as I mentioned, it's kind of a fun meditation that we get when we ordain. Let's see if I can pull up the Pali here. Patikula. Ati imas minkaye, there is in this body kesa, hair of the head, lo ma nakha danta tajo mangsang naharu, ati minchang wakang hadayang yakang ki lo makang, pihakang papa sang antang antaku nangutari yang kang sang, kari sang pitang semhang pupolo hitang sedo medo asu wasa kelo singkale kalasi kamutang. And this is missing the brain. It's only got 30 or 31 parts, I'm not sure. It's missing the brain, but there's another version that has the brain in there, and this one is probably because most people didn't ever take the head apart to see that there was a brain as well. But we'll chant that, and we can chant pieces of it, like the first five. It's the Dajja Panchaka Kamatana, the five external parts of the body: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, kesa, loma, nakha, danta, tajo. Back and forth. And as I mentioned, this is good for people, especially for monks who are trying to be celibate and who have problems with sensual desires. Yes, this is a concept. This is a conceptual. This is why I say this one isn't really. Is this judging? Isn't this judging? Yes, it is in a way judging. As I said, it's generally useful for people who have sensual desire, and it's useful in a limited sense because it's really only repressing. It's called repression by opposites. So our attachment to the body is done away with through revulsion towards it. But it is worth saying, though, that you don't have to make it up. I mean, when you look at the body objectively, you see it's pretty repulsive. There's no jewels, there's no gold, there's no diamonds in the body. There's no beautiful flowers waiting to be discovered. There's no perfumes in the body, right? I mean, we're not trying to promote this on an ultimate sense. There's nothing repulsive or attractive about the body, but what's ridiculous is our idea that somehow the body is beautiful, and we have to admit that all or most of us have this idea that the body is somehow attractive. So, if you're a person who already thinks the body is a disgusting, repulsive thing, and these people do exist, then this meditation is probably not for you. But for most people, it's quite useful because we have this ridiculous notion that this body is full of wonderful things and beautiful and so on. And we're pretty good at pretending. We have all these makeup and cosmetics and perfumes and soaps and so on that hide the smell and the oil and the ugliness of the body. But again, this is a limited meditation. It's something that is useful for, especially for monks who are trying their best to be celibate. It can be useful for novices, useful for beginner meditators. And it just sort of fits into the body, so they just sort of it's just sort of stuck in here. But it doesn't mean that it's the same meditation. Yeah, it's just a tool. Along with mindfulness of the Buddha, along with mindfulness of death, along with metta or loving kindness meditation. These are not considered meditation on ultimate reality, but they're certainly very useful. Mindfulness of the Buddha, just remembering about the Buddha, gives you great faith and confidence and courage. Something that's useful in a limited sense. Loving kindness is very useful. It gives you peace and happiness and freedom from remorse and guilt. It creates harmony in the community and so on. Mindfulness of death is useful because it gives you a sense of urgency and the need to make haste and act today and act now. All of these are not specifically insight meditation or meditation on reality, but they're quite useful for meditators. So this is just included in here. It's actually something that when we're teaching insight meditation, we kind of just skip over. But again, this is sort of a comprehensive text, and so it's in here as well. I mean, and it's in here, it's great. So you can, if you want to look this up, you look it up. It's in there as well for the times when it becomes necessary or useful. And the next one is similar, and I mentioned about the next two actually, reflection on the modes of materiality, the elements, the dhatu. So there are the four elements: earth, air, water, fire. And here they're given explanation. Actually, the translation should just be earth, air, water, and fire, but here we have the mode of solidity, which is the earth element, the mode of cohesion, which is the water element, the mode of calorosity, the fire element, and the mode of oscillation, which is the air element. But the translation is just earth, air, water, and fire. But what he's doing here in this translation is trying to help you understand, you know, how it could be that that's all there is these four elements. That really that's all there is in the body. In an ultimate sense, we don't have a body sitting here. All we have are the four elements, because that's what is experienced. There's the earth, the air, the water, but here's the meaning of them, that it gives you solidity, cohesion, coloricity, and oscillation. Then he gives a nice simile of a clever cow butcher who takes apart the body. But okay, so this, what is meant here in this section is not mindfulness of the body as the four elements necessarily, but actually looking at pieces of the body, like the blood or the teeth as, you know, being hard, or some of them being hot and some of them being sticky and so on. Being able to take it apart and put it in and look at it in pieces. Just like a butcher who looks at pieces of the body. But in meditation practice, we would focus specifically on the elements. In insight meditation practice, we'd focus specifically on the elements. So when we say rising, this is the air element, vayodhatu, the oscillation element. When we say to ourselves sitting, we're focusing on the contact with the floor or the pressure in the back or so on. When we feel hot, we can remind ourselves, say, hot, hot, hot. We're focusing on the fire element. And the last one is cemetery contemplations, which is quite similar to the one I mentioned on Thursday, which is also a focusing on a concept. So I'm going to sort of skip by these. Not that they're not interesting, but in the interest of time, and of course because of the focus of my general teaching and meditation, it's not on these. But for those of you who have read them, if you have any questions, you're welcome to ask me. But in the interest of time, I think I'll stop now, and if there are any questions, you're welcome to ask. Otherwise, thank you all for coming, and see you all next time.